Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
In the heart of these animated wonders, there are tales and symbols older and darker than the castle's highest tower. Welcome to Occult Disney. Journey with Paranoid American and Matthew Comegys as they traverse the intricate pathways of alchemy, the shadowed corners of biblical narratives, and the very folklore that birthed these tales. Beneath every brushstroke lie whispers of writers' taboos, the cloak and dagger politics of hallowed studios, and secrets held close. Every magic has its price, every kingdom its shadows. Are you prepared to peer beyond the veil? Welcome to the Occult Disney Podcast.
Howdy, folks. It's the Occult Disney Podcast. This is Matt here. As always, it's the Paranoid American. Howdy.
Mwahahaha.
I'm getting buckets of rain tossed on my head today. Well, especially if I go outside. So I got a nice gloomy one for a desert movie. I like that.
Yeah, but even when it's gloomy in your part of the world, it's probably still beautiful.
Oh, the mountains look great. You get the floating cloud sort of stuff, you know, like the floating paintings, floating world sort of setting. So, yeah. If I were to take
a look
out.
Can we do one of these episodes with, like, you out and about in, like, a temple or something?
I used to do that when I did the Sci-Fi Sanctuary podcast. My co-host, you know, we actually work at the same company. So we would hike off to temples, and I think we recorded, like, 50 episodes in a temple.
That's cool, man. That's cool. I'm not gonna lie, that's awesome.
Yeah. So I don't know if my bandwidth is looking good for that month, or the name's escaping me. But yeah, it's possible. It's not impossible. I'll say that at least. Might get weird sound quality and wind. We had some recordings where we recorded Spider-Man 2 on the side of the mountain, and the whole podcast you just hear as the wind comes through, which of course
I get some help. AI to clean that up. It's no big deal.
Yeah. Well, that was the auspicious year 2020, so we didn't quite have the easy AI for that yet.
Before the great fall of man.
That's right. Well, you know, there's the book On the Beach where you have the great fall of man, and the final people on the planet are in Australia, so that's where we're going today. For the rescuers down under. Wow,
what
that was the
segue.
Most apocalyptic segue possible.
Tips to you know, donate some money for Matt for the awesome segue in the description.
That's right.
Below.
I can get a Segway scooter with that. So I had to dodge like 8 people on Segways last week when I took my little trip. I'm walking along the beach, and then there's the guide up front who knows what they're doing, and then 7 very unpredictable people on Segways behind them. So I was like, you know, having to jump into the jungle and stuff.
Statistically, that's probably a majority of Segway users are ones that are like just doing it out of novelty and have no idea what they're doing.
Didn't the owner of the company like drive off a cliff or something?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I love those irony stories. Like, was it the Denver airport where the creepy horse sculpture murdered its creator?
Blucifer is his name. Blucifer, and you better put some respect on Blucifer's name, because he's got a body count already.
I know. I went into the Denver airport in maybe 2004, so no mind of like all the weird stuff there at the time. Just
so you saw the mural.
I saw the murals, and yeah, I was like 20, 24,
wait,
25 years old. Just like,
is that a German sword going up that poor girl's? Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay. And there's a dove. All right. What the hell is this?
I was on a I was making a connection to Jackson Hole, and I actually left security and went back into security because the place was so weird. Like, who does that on a layover, you know?
I'm going to go back where it's safe before these German weirdos can get me with the gas masks.
Oh, no, I just wanted to see more of the place because it was so weird.
I remember, I can't remember the last time I was there, but it was probably in like 2008 or 9. But at that point, they had embraced the conspiracy theory culture slowly. And they had banners up that said, like, lizards this way, or it was something like that. Or, like, you know, reptilians hard at work. So I think it's funny, like, little tongue in cheek. But at the same time, I believe they brought someone in to paint back over sections of that mural because they were so controversial. Like, you'd have to go online and find pictures from like the 90s in order to see like the really, really original mural version before they started doing little touch-ups.
Yeah, yeah. I think I hit it at a pretty sweet spot. And was there supposed to be like buried skyscrapers around the airport and stuff? That's a wild. I mean, that's not today's topic, but it is fascinating.
Well, I've heard Underground City, and I've heard that there's like a little podium that has like a Freemason symbol on it. And if you touch it in just the right way, or if you touch your Freemason ring up against it, like a little, you know, elevator comes up and it brings you underground to this whole thing. It sounds awesome. World. Maybe I should try that one time. I didn't bring my Mason ring with me, but I should like touch it just to see what happens.
Welcome. It'll say, you know, somebody's random name if it's not your ring, you know.
Welcome to the Delta Preferred Executive Lounge.
Yep. As for the rescuers down under, this is, I feel like, a somewhat forgotten movie. I mean, I certainly forgot. I'm just like, oh, Little Mermaid, straight to Beauty and the Beast, bang, bang. But this is lying right in the middle.
I'm going to be honest. This is such a forgotten movie than when we did the first Rescuers movie. I accidentally watched this one first and then realized, oh, crap, this wasn't the original Rescuers. And I had to watch the original one again. But when I watched this one, yeah, it was like a new movie.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I hadn't seen it before. When it
before,
came out,
like this week or recently.
Yeah, I had never seen it. Partly for the reason this movie was somewhat of a flop, because this was the next big, you know, they were expecting big things from this movie. When Eisner and Katzenberger came in the mid '80s, they're basically like, okay, what's a recent hit? And in 1985, the most recent hit that Disney Animation had was basically The Rescuers. I mean, that sounds silly now, but from that perspective, it made sense. So they were like, okay, green light a sequel. They got a couple of the animators who had done well in Oliver and Company and sort of rewarded them with directing this movie. And I think things generally went okay. The catch was they released it on the same weekend as Home Alone. And I know I went to see Home Alone at age 10 or whatever, so I didn't see this.
Oh, Home Alone dominated whatever was in my brain for like a good 3 or 4 months when it came out. I mean, and they had, you know, Macaulay Culkin on like Saturday Night Live, and he was just popping up all over the place. So yeah, bad timing, Disney. But also, even rewatching this movie, I liked it. I thought the animation was good. The pacing was pretty good. Like all the technical stuff, I think they'd kind of like sorted out from a level of combining the traditional and like the newer computer assisted anime. Like, you can see that it's in there, but I think it's done very, very well. But it feels like it's like someone just made the wrong decision on like where to set this thing happening. And I can't put my finger on it because I can't pretend that I could get into the ring with like the creatives that were working on this at Disney at the time. But there's just, sorry, Australia, but there was just like something boring. Like, if it just happened somewhere outside of Australia, maybe it would have been more interesting. I don't know. I don't know what it is, but it's missing like a thing that makes me want to watch it over and over again.
That's the other super 80s influence on this movie. 1986 or so, Eisner's old studio had a giant hit with Crocodile Dundee. Then Tom Selleck, I guess, was doing okay with the Quigley Down Under. I remember my father and I going to see Young Einstein because we like Crocodile Dundee. And of course, Young Einstein's like a hot mess of a movie. starring Yahoo Sirius. Yeah. so there was like kind of a, you know, a fad Australian thing going on.
Is this why you think it ended up in Australia? Is just because it was like throw another shrimp on the Barbie was in style at that time?
Yeah, yeah. You know, that's not a knife, this is a knife, all of that. But yeah, that was
right, man. Cheech Marin had a movie, I think, that was in Australia. It was like a thing going on for a while. 80s to mid-90s.
And then, you know, Eisner, of course, he the studio that really had the big Australian hit was the one he had just left. So he's like, I'll show them with my own Australia movie. So the Australia, while it might not have been the best decision, like looking at how it happened, it's like, well, from the perspective of the late 80s, it kind of makes
from a sense. Businessman looking at paper. Yeah, it makes sense, maybe.
For a man who's very uncomfortable on camera, but wants to do introductions for everything. I'm sure you've had enough, hello, I'm Michael Eisner videos you've seen.
I mean, you know, he's a very charming guy, just like oozing charisma, no?
Well, I just loved how he was like, okay, Walt Disney was, you know, he hosted the TV show and all that. So he says, oh, so I'm going to do it too, you know? it's like, today if you had like the Harrison Ford talk show or something where he's the host.
I would love for like the modern executives to have to introduce all the shows still, like on like you put on Disney Channel before something comes on.
Eisner actually did have a talk show in the late 2000s, didn't he?
Like, his own briefly. Talk show? I don't remember.
I believe there's the Michael Eisner show where he actually hosts and like talks to like other execs and stuff.
Yeah, I found our new series.
Yeah, yeah, there's something to look into. Conversations with Michael Eisner, is that what it's called? It's something I've heard about, not watched, because I don't know. I'm not going to block out my time for Michael Eisner's talk show unless I really need to.
There's some MK Ultra, you just put it on in the background, just like psychic driving.
Get triggered, yeah, and it's always fun. What was it? Oh, the other big thing you were talking about, how the animation in this looks really good. And for me, I mean, the Australian said, I'm fine with that. I felt like the story was a little by the numbers. Like, I didn't really feel like it popped much, but the animation super popped. This is considered the first all digital movie ever. Like, it didn't go analog until they pressed it to celluloid to send to theaters, because obviously they weren't doing digital projections. But up to going on film, this was completely digital, where they would scan, you know, pencil designs and then digitally ink them, digitally color them. That's with the cap system.
It's a murky definition now, because even as you describe that, it's like, yeah, I guess it's all digital from a certain perspective, but also like in the coming movies they'd start using just like Wacom tablets, and then in the coming movies they might like no one has ever actually put a pencil to paper, not necessarily exactly like that, because even in Toy Story, of course, they had animatics and storyboard designers and stuff, but like this one I still count as hand-drawn a little bit, traditional, at least compared to where we're at today.
Yeah, a little bit. I think this is basically the method that Japanese anime studios like use now, because
what's that? There's
just still where they are hand drawing things, but then scanning, and then the end product is actually completely digital. So it's kind of like when comic books made the change to digital. I mean, comic books today look extremely different than, you know, from when I was growing up or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, in a lot of different ways. Although that's a whole rabbit hole too of like traditional versus digital in illustration, because there's a lot of artists that I work with that bounce between the two depending on what they want the style to look like, on if they're going to start digital and do everything in Photoshop or, you know, Clip Studio Pro or whatever they use, or if they do it in like actual pen and paper and scan it and then go back over it digitally. It gives you, and there's some publisher, I think like Fantagraphics is one, where they don't allow any digital artwork at all. Like anything that you turn into Fantagraphics has to be traditional, and I believe you have to like mail them the originals and everything.
Wow. Yeah,
but then they scan it and turn it digital. So
I mean, you know, for me, obviously I can barely draw, and I'm going to do digital stuff, right? Because that's more convenient. And
are
I mean,
you
I don't
a prompt
any...
artist? I'm an AI prompt artist now.
Yeah, yeah, really. Well, the fun is, I guess, doing all the prompts. But as we've talked before, if you're doing the stuff with the AI, you do quickly start to see where the walls of that particular cube are, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like,
although that's when you can get nerdy and start training it all the new stuff you want it to know about.
Yeah, I guess you got to get like a nice swank one and pay for it to do that, though, don't you?
Or you run it in the cloud at this point. I do stuff in the cloud. Shout out to my other podcast, Paranoid Programming, where I walk through all of that. But I use a handful of them where you basically just rent a computer out in the sky for 50 cents an hour or something. And then you can do all this stuff regardless of what hardware you've got.
We talked a little bit about with the Rescuers being kind of like the first time where Disney had real celebrity voices, which they brought back in 1990. Although in 1990, Bob Newhart does still have his sitcom on the air, but he doesn't seem like he's definitely not young and hip. I guess he never was. That's his shtick. But
the only voice that really stood out to me was John Candy in this one.
Oh yeah, that's
and he took over from, I forgot who did the voice in the previous movie.
I've got the name, but yeah, that guy just, you know, he died shortly before they made this. So
yeah, that guy, and then John Candy, and then that guy.
Yeah, of course. Now that I guess they would like digitally recreate that guy whose name is coming up in a moment. Oh no, that's just talking about. Wow. Yeah, oh, yeah. It's harder to find that name when you're looking at the name of the new movie. Okay. That guy. Sorry. He's going to be that guy. Sorry, dude. I know you have a name. Jim Jordan. There we go. I found it. Okay. Sorry, AKA Jim Jordan, guy. who I now have named. Yeah. Jim Jordan, a.k.a. that guy. Yeah. You know, everybody wants some candy, right? You're getting your candy for this movie. Until the end of the movie. I think my last note is nobody wants candy because they leave him on a literal cliffhanger, but he's a bird, so I guess it's okay.
Well, he can get back home because he's the one that got him there.
Yeah, he's the transport. So
what were the other voices in this movie? Because I guess I didn't make a note for any of them standing out except for John Candy.
Yeah, well, Bob Newhart's returning as the Bernard. Eva Gabor is here. This is her last film role before her death as Miss Bianca.
Really?
So, in this one, Miss Bianca is being voiced by a very elderly lady. Here's the one where I didn't even realize this till halfway through, and then I was like, of course. Georgie Scott is our villain, Percival C. McLeach. So, of course, he of Dr. Strangelove and Patton. So that's a perfect voice for your villain, I think. But he did it one better the year after this. Do you remember something called Cartoon All-Stars to the Rescue?
The name sounds familiar, but I'm struggling for the visual.
It was a special.
Was it Cartoon All-Stars to the Rescue?
That's correct. Yeah, it was a special that was aired on all of the networks and some cable stations where they got all the properties together, the Ninja Turtles, the Muppet Babies, Mickey Mouse is there, Bugs Bunny is there. With an intro from the Bushes, Barbara and Daddy Bush.
Is this also, you know, the Nintendo cartoon? What's his
name? It's not. This was a Stay Off of Drugs cartoon. And the villain in that is also voiced by George C. Scott. So I do recommend
All-Star. I have to watch this
cartoon
as well.
All-Stars to the Rescue. Smoke.
Yeah, dude, it's got the Muppet Babies. It's got the Winnie the Pooh characters, Alvin the Chipmunks, Bugs Bunny. There's a ghost, which I assume is drugs, maybe. There's a Ninja Turtle. That's Alf.
That's George C. Scott. Alf. That's George C. Scott. He plays a sentient cloud of marijuana smoke called Smoke.
Thank you for bringing this up. I have to look at this, though.
Pretty much doing the same voice from this movie, except instead of like a nasty Australian scalp hunter or whatever he is, he's now a sentient cloud of drug smoke. I don't think they say marijuana smoke. I think he's just drug smoke.
Yeah, this is it right here. Oh, I don't want to play the video, but there's a little puff of smoke that I assume that we're talking about here. So that's him.
Yeah. So,
oh, okay. I don't remember this. I don't remember this at all. I'm going to have to watch this. This is awesome.
You did not have your TV on that day in 1990 or 1991, I suppose.
Probably not.
I've heard of some elementary schools showing this in class.
Oh man, some of this looks real familiar, although I don't know if it was just like repurposed, but some of this looks very familiar.
You might have just seen it when it was airing, because if you were watching cartoons that day, you saw this. They made everybody watch it. Hmm.
You know what? I think maybe this is the guy that gave me my first joint too. That's where I recognize this from.
Ah, okay. What did I have? That was from a black guy named Black at a Halloween party. BLAQUE.
Did you name him, or did he name himself that?
He named himself that.
It makes a big difference. You don't want
to. Oh, it makes a giant difference. No. I was just like, the person. That or smoke. A smoke, I mean, of course, would be amazing. But if you've probably had some drugs already, if you're meeting smoke, as the cartoon All Stars to the Rescue suggests. You know, he's like, hey, you like me? Why don't you try some heroin now?
I actually want to see like a whole series on that. Yeah, like I want to see like the DMT version. I want to see the PCP version.
Yeah.
I mean, out of all the people in the world that you could see draw, well, I guess not in the world. That's a little expansive, because you've probably seen a lot of cool animation. But like the drunken elephants in Dumbo, right? Imagine if they just expanded on that and they were like, let's do every drug. Literally, and also, you know, like anime every drug. But
Pinocchio's got some, Alice in Wonderland has some. You could make a supercut that probably does that with existing movies. Even this one has a little bit of... This one has the flying segment is a little bit trippy in this. I mean, that doesn't suggest they're on anything, but this is a better flying sequence than the first Rescuers, probably because they had, you know, better animation.
Yeah. My opinion, this movie is superior to the original Rescuers in almost every way, except
the villain.
The villain for sure, but I mean, it's in a weird way. Like the first Rescuers villain was more villainy. You know what I mean? Like,
well, she was Cruella DeVille, like with a slight reskin, you know, where despite having a fantastic voice, the rest of him is kind of bland. Like his motivations are kind of, I mean, his motivations just feel like the system, you know, or something.
The poacher.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I think he's just like too damn like good looking. Like he's too, like he doesn't have like the weird Maleficent horn silhouette or like that old hag archetype working for him. He's got the I'm Crocodile Dundee, but I'm like a mean version of him. But you're still right. Like, yeah, but you're Crocodile Dundee. Like how bad could you really be?
Yeah, you can't follow up a grotesque villain with a dude. I mean, they did, but what can you do?
Or like a Chad dude specifically.
Like Smoke should be in this movie. Smoke should be the poacher.
Smoke should be in every Disney movie. That would be a cool reoccurring character. Just saying, like just every once in a while he comes in, like gives someone a joint. They turn into a bad person.
Yeah. So Cartoon All-Stars every week. That sounds great. But where were we going with that? Smoke. Here's the other distinction. This came up recently. Did you ever watch the Nightmare on Elm Street remake? It's not very good, but did you happen to see it?
Yeah, oh yeah, I've seen every one of them. Although, yeah, the remake doesn't stick in my mind as much as some of the older ones.
Okay, because that kind of applies to this and maybe to the first Rescuers, because in the remake, it's the Jackie Earl something. The guy who played Rorschach in Watchmen is him, but yeah, in that one, it's shown that Freddy was also like molesting the kids.
Yeah, they turned him like, because there was ways that you could look at him as like almost a good guy in some ways. Like, if
they're
you
trying
really
to save
it,
him at first, right, in that movie.
Yeah, but yeah, as soon as that version came out, it's like, okay, like no, you can't stand for Freddy anymore.
And Wes Craven actually made a statement. When that movie came out, he didn't like it. He was like, no, Freddy is not a child molester. He's only a child murderer. It's like, oh, okay, that makes it okay. Which I feel like the Rescuers kind of has that going on too a little bit. It's like,
yeah, oh, no, you're
just,
not wrong.
Just murder the children. It's yeah. So it's they're not, you know,
you know,
really
I
doesn't
kidnapped
go
the
that.
Children and I put the children in cages and I put them in these like underground layers where they're protected by, you know, reptiles. But we're not going to do anything horrible except for kill them. Like, we're not going to do any weird stuff.
Yeah. I guess hanging them over, a bunch of alligators is pretty weird stuff. But not that kind of weird stuff. It's just murder, you know?
We're not going to be playing, like, ping pong or eating pizza or anything weird like that.
Right, right. Oh, my.
No handkerchiefs.
I did feel that they... I'm not going to say recycled, because reusing your animation or your designs is smart. And yeah, our salamander in here definitely was a bit of a Ka, the snake again, which we've had for the third time.
Yeah, I didn't pick it up as much, but now that you say it, yeah, I guess I can see it there now.
I mean, if you didn't pick up on it, that's great, because that means they did it well. So,
I honestly didn't pick up on any reused animation. I wasn't looking for it as much, just because I guess right from the beginning, I was sort of like pleasantly surprised. Like, this felt like a movie that should have had more reviews and that more people should be watching, I guess, except for the boring Australia part. But I mean, as it comes in, it's got an amazing intro. Because we've been talking about, like, what are your favorite intros? And I guess this point we're almost at like a fork in the road, where it's maybe no longer about which one hits the nostalgia the hardest, because arguably the Robin Hood, I think, is still my favorite intro. And it's not because it's technically impressive or anything. It just has the song and the animation. I just like the aesthetic of it. But now we're going to get into, I like from here forward, I think, like, technical animations for the intros and like how impressive they are. So anyways, this one was really impressive because it comes right in and it feels fully 3D. It's got parallax. It's got like multiple planes of depth and like camera focus. The camera moves and rotates around in a way that doesn't feel like it was from, what one was this movie? 1990 something?
1990, yeah.
Like, I mean, it didn't feel like it had the 1990 look when you see other 3D animated films from 1990. And I think, again, because a lot of this stuff was done like frame by frame, even if it was in a digital workflow, it wasn't like you were just tweening, have the camera here and then have the camera there. Someone was actually doing it frame by frame at some level.
But doing it with a physical camera and their old playing cameras, that would have been 100 times the work and basically impossible.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah. It would have been impossible to do this kind of thing without seeing like jitters and stuff, but they do it really well. I mean, this intro, I might be overselling it here too. Like, someone's gonna go and watch it and be like, what is this garbage? But I swear, you put this intro on at the beginning of like a modern animated movie, it holds up. Like, it really does have very high fidelity.
Well, the 90s is really where because in 1990 you could still just slap a title card on your movie and call it a day for a big blockbuster, where by the year 2000, now you got to have something like whack, like, Armageddon starting your movie. So, or Fight Club, there's a good one. With the moving through the brain from the Fear Center credits, if you remember in Fight Club, which was budgeted separately.
Yeah, I don't know if that was actually one of my favorites, man.
It's not one of my favorites. It's just the point is it was budgeted separately. They were like, okay, Fox, if you like the movie, give me a little bit more for the credits, because otherwise I'm just going to slap a title screen on there. So,
I don't know if
did the same thing better.
I could have done without those credits. There's some credits that enhance movies, and others that I can count them on like one finger, probably.
Yeah, I guess in 1999, I was there on opening night, and just hearing like, Dust Brothers music on it was kind of like shocking in 1999, because you still didn't hear much of that in movies. Because even The Matrix, starts with it starts with the orchestral swell and not the techno quite. It takes a few minutes to get to that.
That was when everyone's parents were forced to listen to Rage Against the Machine at the very end.
That's right. where was I going to with that? I think I finished making that point. I don't remember.
I want to mention too, because you were mentioning some like recurring themes, and the last thing you mentioned was how the what the hell is the lizard crocodile thing? What the hell is it, anyways?
Oh yeah, I wrote salamander, like maybe like evil salamander. Let's see what the official credit on him is. Voiced by Frank Welker there. That's fun. Who, he shows up in... No, excuse me. He does... Oh, okay. Joanna is McLeish's pet Goanna. So I guess that's a Goanna, not a salamander. Frank Welker voices Joanna as well as Marta Hute. Frank Welker being famous for doing Megatron and animals in every movie. He just shows up in movies and makes a bunch of weird sounds, which I love.
Oh, you mean like not doing the voice of animals, just making animal noises?
Yeah, he doesn't say any words in this. He has two roles where he just goes, ah, ah. And he does this in like so many movies. If you look up Frank Welker's filmography, it's insane. He's one of those guys.
There was this will be the shortest tangent ever, but I remember in boot camp, there was like towards the end when everyone starts getting comfortable and like knowing each other and being able to joke around a little bit, and you also start understanding the schedule, so you know when you can like goof around before the TI comes in and like, you have to act serious. And there was like a certain times of the night when I swear we had like six or seven people in our flight that were as good as Michael Winslow and at least doing animal noises. And they would turn the entire place into like a rainforest where someone would like start doing like crickets, and then another person would like throw an owl out there, and another person would like, and all of a sudden, like almost everyone's contributing to this, like, and it would sound crazy. It would sound like an actual, like you were outside in some jungle or something. So anyway, I don't know why that tangent came up, but yeah, people making animal noises.
No, I got a coworker who, when he's bored, he'll just sit, like we're sitting there waiting for the meeting to start, and he'll just start making like bird noises, like bird call noises. So
that's not annoying. That's definitely socially acceptable.
Other people don't join in. It doesn't become a jungle,
no, it would be weird.
even on the little company trip last week, yeah, we're on the bus. I'm sitting next to him, and he starts doing that. One of the Japanese teachers like, "Oh, is that a bird?" No, it's not a bird.
This is another random tangent, but it makes sense here. But I actually worked with Michael Winslow for a very short amount of time in two different areas. One is that he was working with the company I was at when we were at Disney. And he would just come in and do like consultation stuff for like a week. And I think we were trying to pitch some ideas and having him like, it was kind of like the badge on the shirt. You could be like, "Oh, Michael Winslow's here. Oh, wow." And then hold the meeting. And it was kind of impressive. Oh, the guy from, you know, Police Academy. And then he was also one of my artists that I work with when I did music. He was the sound man for Michael Winslow. So when Michael Winslow would come to Orlando or even go on the road and do like stand-ups or do like little one-offs, like my friend Chi King was the one that would, you know, be his sound man. And on both of these instances, I remember Chi King, bro, would tell me the funniest stories that he would go to like a grocery store. They'd go to like Publix or something with Michael Winslow. And as the ladies are going there and doing like boop, boop, he would just throw a couple extra ones in there and like it would just throw them off. And they're like looking at it and checking the receipt, just like little things like that. And on a plane, he would do the like bing. And the stewardesses would like keep walking up and down the aisles looking to see who was hitting the button, but no one was. I don't know. It sounds hilarious, but when he was doing the same thing at Disney, he would do it in the middle of these meetings and make like a sound like someone's cell phone was going off, or like, and it really like it got to the president like real bad. Like he was not having fun with it after like day two. And man, I just love, that's one of my favorite memories. Michael Winslow just doing his thing and annoying people over it. It was awesome.
I mean, if something like that happens, you look up and see Michael Winslow, you should be able to put it together. Or maybe you haven't seen the Police Academy movies. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's not like he was advertising. And like, if you're just doing your thing and you're a, you know, 16-year-old ringing people up, you know, maybe you've never seen Michael Winslow or know what any of this is about. He's amazing. If you ever, he'd have like a whole series where he just emulates specific time period typewriters. And like each key, I don't know, it's insane, man.
Yeah, the only thing I remember,
he doesn't get enough credit in
movies besides that, is the someone would accidentally stumble into the Blue Oyster in every movie. That's the other thing I remember from those movies. The two things I remember from Police Academies.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
I'm so sorry I'm late. I was just talking to my sister about protecting abortion rights.
Wait, didn't we already do that in Ohio? We passed issue 1 last year.
I know, by a wide margin too. But now it's up to our state Supreme Court to decide whether they enforce it or ignore it.
Ignore it? Will they really do that?
They will if we don't keep extremists out of the court. But we can protect our rights by electing Justices Donnelly, Stewart, and Forbes.
I don't know if I can remember that. Listen, I can barely remember what I had for breakfast this morning.
Here's a trick. All you have to do is remember, don't stop fighting.
Don't stop fighting. Oh, I get it. DSF, Donnelly Stewart Forbes. I love that.
Tell everyone you know, if you supported issue 1 last year, don't stop fighting. Vote for Donnelly Stewart and Forbes.
This message was paid for by Red, Wine, and Blue, a community of women who care about reproductive rights as much as you do.
Where were we?
Okay. Yeah, exactly. Where were we? Police Academy. We were just talking about who was doing voices for animals. Apparently, someone has a lot of credits for just animal noises.
Oh, Megatron. Yes, Megatron does a lot of animals as well. So it's awesome if you can make a career out of that. Voice acting. Hey, it's a thing, right?
So I got a couple notes here. One of them is that, again, we have a reoccurring Disney theme, which... It feels like so ubiquitous. If you just watch any Disney movie, it just feels like, oh yeah, it's part of the formula and you don't even realize it. But since we started at movie 1, right, at Snow White, and worked ourselves all the way up to 1990, there's this absolutely like beating you over the head recurring theme of that this innocent kid can talk to nature. And here we go again. The kid can talk to animals, but other people can't. Like the adults can't necessarily talk to the animals the way that this kid can. So it's that to me is standing out as one of the most important things that Disney is relying on, either as a formula or it's because it means something really deep to them beyond just the surface.
Are the rules clear? Like, can Bernard talk to everybody? I mean, some of the animals seem like slightly more civilized. I guess there's like a hierarchy of class to these animals, right? Where Joanna the Goanna is basically feral. So, and then we get all the way up to Bernard, who is Bob Newhart level. So,
right. So, but could Bernard talk directly to McLeach or vice versa? Or is it like you have to be worthy enough to even hear them speak? Or are they just like really careful about not letting, you know, the profane hear them when they talk? It's undefined, but it seems implied that if you're a child and you're innocent, then you're automatically able to talk to animals. Like, there's no special rules for that. It only gets special once you start determining, oh, are you an adult? Oh, wait, are you a villain? And then it's kind of on the fence, and it's kind of like up to each movie's rule set. But in general, if you're a kid and you're innocent, you can talk to animals. That's the Disney way.
Obviously, we're going to get into this in about 5 episodes, but do you think, like, in pop culture in general, does Toy Story start to solidify those rules a little bit? Or
Which
at least it has a... Toy Story has a very clear set of rules where we can talk to each other. And then there's like a hierarchy of toys where some seem, you know, like not as sentient as others.
I mean, on it, yeah. So to answer you, I think it does solidify it because that's the entire premise of Toy Story, is that these like entities only operate when you're not looking. It's like a double slit experiment, right? But like your toys. But there was another movie that I think I've brought up a couple times before. I think it's called Christmas Story or something. And it was a combination of Disney Channel and Jim Henson, I think. And it was basically all of this kid's toys would come to life when someone left the room, and one of them gets like trapped, and it's actually like, I remember it scaring me a little bit, creeping me out as a kid. But that was essentially Toy Story. And if we're discounting Brave Little Toaster, because Brave Little Toaster, I think, is its own weird dimension, like that belongs in its own thing. But I do believe that it starts there. And then the real solidification that happens in Toy Story, though, is the Disney proxy, where we say your parents are gone. Here's this new, you know, animated character. It's going to be your parent now. Next time you see it at the store, you know, buy it. But now it's going to be like the Toy Story. Hey, not only is this an IP character, but it's a real toy. It's a thing that you can, like, this toy that you're seeing walking and talking and looking at you, you can buy this exact toy at the store, and it has the same soul that you're seeing on camera. It's no longer like the plastic version of Bambi or the stuffed version of Dumbo. It's like you can buy Woody, like the real Woody that you saw in the movie, and there's a good chance that when you leave the room, he comes to life. And you better buy Buzz Lightyear, and you better buy like all the other ones, otherwise they'll be lonely. And it even, like, we'll go into random tangents, but even the last Toy Story 4, at the very end, where, like, the toys get on this conveyor belt, and it's, like, once they've been passed down so many times and no one wants it anymore, they basically throw it into, like, an incinerator. It's the Brave Little Toaster again, right? When they go to the junkyard. But the whole thing is, like, no, I have to save these toys because I can't replace that Woody. That Woody has a soul, and that Woody like knows about me, and I've saved it, and it saved me, and it can't be replaced. And they like it. That becomes the entire mission of the movie, is save the toys from being thrown out. But then I'm just thinking too, like, it's just a toy. Like, you can just go and buy another Woody. So the impact of teaching kids, like, no, the Woody that you grew up with, that one has the soul. And if you lose it, like, you basically killed your Woody. And if you get a new one, that's like if you accidentally killed your dog and you just go out and buy a new dog. So that, in a very oversimplified version, but that's what Toy Story solidifies the most, I think.
Well, he did a fantastic confusing of that, or amplification of that, last year with the Lightyear movie, because it's like, okay, this was Andy's Star Wars in his universe. No, this is not the Buzz that was in the Toy Story movies. We don't want to hire Tim Allen right now. So it's a different Buzz.
That's what it was, yeah.
So it was just like, if you look up their press release on that, the wording is just like beyond vague and confusing, you know? So
I haven't seen it yet. Is it worth the watch?
No, we don't like it. Turned out people, I didn't see it either, but the word on the street is that we don't like Andy's Star Wars. So, I mean, you know, it could be like Andy really loves Sky Captain, The World of Tomorrow, and that was his Star Wars. And the rest of us don't like it that much, you know? It could
Andy
be like
in front
that.
Of a green screen for 2 hours.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's got to be some kids out there that were obsessed with that. It's like how people who are maybe like 25 right now, like, we're like, yeah, I really like the prequels because I grew up with them, right? The Star Wars prequels. So
I mean that was my favorite one, was the one that came out in 2001, the one that had the Anakin that everyone was being mean to. That's my favorite Star Wars to date still.
That's the sand is coarse.
Yeah, the sand court. Yeah, the race car one.
It's everywhere.
You can tell how much I like Star Wars. Like, yeah, the desert race course thing. Yeah, I don't know any of the...
No, just since I was at the beach last week, I just kept saying that to people until they, like, wanted to hit me, you know? I don't like sand. It's coarse, and it gets everywhere. Because it's, like, spilling out of my backpack. Yeah. The biggest mistake is I like snorkeling, and I was like, I'll be smart this time. I bought fake Crocs. But then I wanted to buy souvenirs, so I was like, okay, at the hotel, I'll dump the shoes and save it for souvenirs. But then right after that, we got to go snorkeling. One of my coworkers saw me going in and out of the water, like just walking over coral. So, yeah, and the snorkeling was fun, but getting over that was a nightmare. I think my hands
like stepping on, like, the coral, like we're trying to, like, rebuild the coral from scratch, and Matt's just, like, stomping through it.
Well, I think I don't think it was actual coral. It was just sharp rocks. You swim out.
You
can coral.
Backtrack. We got you on tape. You've been destroying coral.
Because they have volcanic rocks and stuff too. So this was at a resort. Though. It was like right at the beach of the resort. So if there was anything living right there, it was
bleach the hell anyways.
Yeah. Well, I got out. Actually, true. Because when I got on the water, it was fun. I saw a cool fish, but the coral there was nothing compared to the other place where you have to drive out to, and there's nothing there, and the coral's extremely psychedelic. So, yeah, if you want to go,
you mean like if you lick it,
you don't lick the coral. maybe. Hey, that's a good thought. Just no, but if you swim down, they also have the Okinawan sea snakes, which are like the first or second most poisonous snake in the world. And when I was swimming out last week, I saw three. They're just, you know, they're 3 meters under you, and they're pretty docile. But if you rile them, they will, you know, immediately kill you, basically. Like, all the beaches have signs like, we have some extremely toxic animals here. Do watch out for them.
Just a bunch of Karens.
Yeah, it's a death trap out there. But, signs in Japanese. I didn't have to read the details. Actually, I think it was in English, too. I don't remember. I have a picture of it somewhere. Of course, I guess Australia is also the notorious death trap country for some of its flora and fauna. Does this movie really make the bush, the outback, seem, you know, super dangerous, or is it just our poacher friend?
That, but also it just seems like dry. But then also there's like waterfalls in the middle of nowhere. I don't know. It's all over the place. They could have said this took place at the Grand Canyon, and it wouldn't have made any difference to me, I don't think.
Yeah, because George C. Scott's barely working on his Australian accent much. He's mostly just doing himself. So,
what would be something that would be like uniquely Australian that would happen here that would make it more interesting? I can't even think.
Aboriginals, maybe? They certainly don't show up in this movie.
They sure don't, and they absolutely would have made it more interesting.
Yeah. You know,
have there been Aboriginals in any Disney movie yet? Have they not gotten to that checkbox yet?
Have they gotten back to Australia in any Disney movies? Well, we're going to see how they at least deal with a different group of people than Pocahontas, and maybe not in the best way. So that'll be an interesting one when we get to it. So they did that. What else have they?
Are they redoing a Snow White and the Seven Dwarves in live action? Isn't one of those dudes Australian? They got one of everything in that movie, I think.
Oh God, that's coming up next. Okay, I mean, that wasn't even on my radar. But I mean, the live action Pinocchio. Like, we did the Pinocchio podcast before I realized there was a live action new Pinocchio. So,
I mean, honestly, that's one of the strongest Disney theories that I believe is holding true, is that they just release crap movies to raise the stock of their original movies, and there's no downside to it at all.
No, I'm almost willing to say that's not a theory anymore. That's a business plan. That's I mean, it makes sense if you're looking at it from a you know, dollars and cents points of view. And that's one of the issues with the American entertainment thing right now. I mean, the people running the show were always bastards, but they used to be more creative bastards, where now they're just like, I have a, you know, MBA bastardry. Or my daddy put me here and we're rich. So I guess that happens a fair amount too.
Yeah, I don't know if there's a better way to do it. Like some gladiator battles. Whoever kills the previous best director gets to direct the next movie.
Well, we almost have that with like Elon Musk going to cage match with Zuckerberg, you know? We need more of that going on.
There's something interesting too about like these tech nerds that need to become like jujitsu champions and fight each other physically, because like they were never in that space for the first 30 years of their lives.
Yeah, I guess I'm happy that I still get to be a bit of a film dork. Like, I saw a headline this morning on, maybe it was Japan Today or something, talking about upcoming releases, and I thought I read Mank, as in like the movie about the guy who wrote Citizen Kane. But and then I couldn't find the information I was looking for. Oh, I mixed up with Musk. And this is a documentary about Musk and Twitter. So, which I don't think that's depressing right now. So Give that one a few years. Too soon, man. Too soon.
It is a little soon, yeah. And don't dead name X. It's X now.
Right, right. Well, yeah, but the documentary I can say is about Twitter because it obviously was about everything that happened before that. So, you know, it's the artist formerly known as Twitter. Yes. What else do you have in your notes?
I got some sporadic ones. So let me start with. Man, I'm going to butcher some of these names, but Marahute, the great golden eagle. So I had to look.
I already mispronounced that.
Did I?
No, I did. Oh. I think.
So I was just looking up to see, does Australia actually have a great golden eagle? And so there is something called a golden eagle, which is one of the most common eagles, but it's not the one that's pictured in the movie. The one that's pictured in the movie is actually a wedge-tailed eagle, which is the largest eagle in Australia. But that one doesn't have like a gold look to it. So the golden eagle is likely a combination of like a mythical version of the eagle. I mean, you just make it gold and it's automatically mythical, right? But the largest eagle is actually this wedge-tailed eagle, and it kind of looks similar to how they draw. I don't know if that matters, but I made all of these notes and I went on a rabbit hole. So you're going to hear about it anyways.
Are they big enough for a boy and several mice to?
Not quite. Okay. I mean, the boy part throws it off a little bit, but the wedge-tailed eagle could definitely pull a boy up and maybe drop him a few times and turn him into food. But I don't know if you could like ride it like a drone. You can't like put things on a drone, but you can have him lift stuff. And it might be based on something called Haast's eagle. And Haast's eagle, trust me, there's like a whole eagle tangent here, but I found something interesting that these types of eagles are known as kleptoparasites or kleptoparasitic eagles, which is sort of like a vulture, except the difference is that these eagles will wait for something else to kill something and then they'll swoop in and take the kill, sort of like Bigfoot, the Bigfoot stories where like the hunter kills the deer and then Bigfoot comes and like takes the carcass and runs away, and it's like, I'm Bigfoot, I live here, I get to take the deer, like this is more mine than yours, and you're not allowed to, yeah, like so there's this concept here though of this particular eagle. So what I'm saying is that the boy is in great danger. He's in a lot of danger right now because this eagle that he's, you know, trying to save is a kleptoparasitic eagle, which is not the kind that you probably want to be around. But anyways, it was hunted, this particular eagle was hunted to extinction in the year 1400, and this was the largest eagle known to have existed in the world. So I don't know, I thought that was all fascinating. So maybe this Marahute, the great golden eagle, could be a version of this Haast eagle, which apparently went extinct in the 1400s. So maybe it's like the, you know, this long lost sort of missing link of eagles that he comes across. And that would explain why all of a sudden it's got this like incredibly important role in the story.
I guess that means our knowledge is mostly like forensic about these eagles though, yeah? Because when the British show up, 1750, something like that. So
right, yeah. And so the story on that, I've got the receipts for this in case anyone really cares about the eagle. But so the Haast eagle had a total population of about 4,500 breeding pairs. And the current thinking is that early human settlers in New Zealand, so the ancestors of the Maori tribe, they came in like 1280. So when they got there, they preyed almost exclusively on flightless birds and hunted those birds to extinction in like around 1400. And as a result from them hunting the flightless birds to extinction, then the eagles didn't have anything to hunt, so they just kind of naturally died off over time since humans had taken over their food supply. So anyways, that's, you know, welcome, you're welcome, Earth. Humans are here.
When you start looking at the actual ecosystems, it is pretty interesting. I was finishing up a book about the you know, like cattle ranching in the late 19th century and stuff, and just how important wolves actually were to that ecosystem. So when they finally did start reintroducing them in the 1990s, you know, everything wildly changed with the animal populations.
We went over this a little bit too in the Bambi episode. So I highly recommend going back and listening to that one, because that one was interesting that deer have no natural predators other than humans culling them with cars and guns, basically. And that if we didn't cull them, then like, what do you do with all of them? They start eating all of the produce. There would be more deers alive that would be eating more produce that are meant for humans. And then it turns into this like nightmarish cycle. So there's actually a reason that you want to kill Bambi's mom, long story short.
Yeah, nightmare deer.
Yeah. I mean, you hit one going 60 in the dark, it's definitely a nightmare deer.
Yeah, hey, I've done my call that way, which I probably told in that podcast, so I won't do it again. But
and then the final note on all of like the statistics about the eagles and everything. That eagle, the Haas eagle that went extinct around 1400, was the largest predator among New Zealand's prehistoric fauna. It is the largest, heaviest eagle species ever described, weighing up to 17.8 kilograms, which is what, just shy of 40 pounds for all my Imperial homies.
That sounds about right.
And it had a wingspan of 3 meters. So I don't know if you could ride it necessarily, 40 pound bird, but it could ruin your day. Put it that way.
Well, little Cody was probably malnourished by that point anyway.
That's so. Right in the middle of the outback. Yeah, dehydrated.
He's actually quite emaciated under that t-shirt.
So speaking of, there's a scene when he gets tickled by the talons of the eagle, like it actually tickles him, and he's like, ha, ha, ha. And I mean, eagle talons, from what I've ever heard, I've never touched one, but they're like supposed to be one of like the sharpest and most hurdy, pointy things that you could ever interact with. And this kid's just like giggling, playing with the eagle's talons. It seems, again, he's putting himself in grave danger here.
Hey, that's the outback, isn't it? A world of danger.
He also, if you notice in the beginning when he's riding on his back, the eagle like does this dive, and it's like fun, you know, like, oh, I'm on a roller coaster. But that's the exact move that eagles will tend to do with their prey, is they bring them up really high, where the oxygen is a little bit, you know, lighter, and then they'll just do like a massive dip, and that quick change in air pressure can just make you unconscious. It's kind of the precursor to them knocking you out and killing them. So it mm-hmm. I don't know, just like as I'm watching this animation again, it's like, all right, like the kid's playing with the talons, that doesn't look good. Up, oh, now the eagle's bringing him up to where the air's thinner. Oh, now he's dropping back down. This is not looking good. This klepto parasitic bird's about to have a nice meal.
You know, my notice that yeah, he's going Bush the bad way. So Bernard too, he's just like, I'm just gonna stroll off into the desert and hope for the best, which is his big plan in this movie, I guess.
It's a great plan.
I mean, I guess Bernard is sort of ending it all, because by that time his lady mouse has been kidnapped as well.
And he knows that Zsa Zsa's on her last leg, so there's nothing left for him to really care about.
Yeah, yeah. Bob Newhart stumbling off into the desert. That's take why animation's fun. You don't have to see that.
And then what else did I got here? Oh, I mean, I had a joke about it, but I would legitimately say this is really good exposition when the kid realizes that the eagle doesn't have like a father, and he's like, oh, where's the daddy eagle? And then he's like, gets a little tear in his eye, and he's like, oh, my dad's gone too. And I just thought it was really good exposition, because there's so many other movies or TV shows or stories where they're like, oh, wow, this reminds me of when my dad died when I was, you know, 4. And it's just so unnatural for it to come out in this weird, like, blatant exposition-y way. So whenever someone sneaks in, like, really smooth exposition, that just impresses me. So I thought this was a really good way of doing that one. And then when he's given this golden feather, I feel like that's probably one of the most symbolic parts of the movie, just because the golden feather has a role in lots of other stories.
Well, it's a pretty literal talisman, and becomes a plot point in this. I mean, that's how the poacher figures out that the boy's in cahoots with the bird, which is actually a pretty weird weird conclusion to make. But yeah, sure.
Well, and I mean, so this one is where it gets into the more woo-woo, like reading into the symbolism. But you've got the poacher, who, by the way, his first name is Percival, which can be broken into Pierce the Veil. And if he's in search of this golden feather, right? Let's say that he's got Joanna, this lizard that he can't necessarily understand and have the same kind of communication that the kid has with nature, but like they understand each other. He can talk to it and he can observe, you know, what Joanna's doing, but they don't have that same communication, but he's in search of it. And he went, and like the golden feather kind of represents that ability to commune with nature the way that the kid can do it so effortlessly. So the whole time Percival is really like in search of that knowledge that is only accessible to this like pure spirit kid. So maybe he had it at one point, or maybe he realized, like, it seems unfair that this guy that's been like out in the middle of the wilderness, like his whole life, lives in a cave essentially. He has less in common with nature than this sheltered kid does that gets kidnapped.
Yeah. I was sitting here trying to think of if I had a different connection with nature as a child. I remember thinking a giant bush was a convincing spaceship at some point. So that happened outside of my elementary school. But then as a Boy Scout, and you know, I love hiking, but I usually don't want to camp. So I was usually tired with nature, especially if it was raining relatively quickly. I mean, today it's raining. I'm going to take a hike around, but that's different. I'm going to come home and I can take a shower or something. So
I was outdoorsy. I mean, upstate New York was much nicer to be outside than, you know, Southern Florida. But I remember doing all of the, I think it was common, but like just lifting up rocks and finding snake, like gardener snakes, you know, not like anything bad. Gardener snakes and little roly polies and worms and chopping worms in half, thinking that they would like grow another half and, you know, convince myself they did. But I'm pretty sure I just murdered many, many worms. But yeah, and just like getting dirty and digging and just like just digging down and finding things that moved and then naming them and they became your pets. Like that was fun for a good portion of my youth.
But I guess you didn't have conversations with them as
you'd be surprised. Or did you? Well, it was, okay, there were one-sided conversations that I never thought they talked back. But I want to say that out of the hundreds of hours that I spent being indoctrinated by Disney, I was absolutely convinced that if I knew the right way to talk to them, they could talk back to me at some point.
I was, you know, a big X-Men fan. So I just assumed one day I'd start shooting lasers out of my eyes, you know, and that would,
you
got to
drink toxic sludge first.
Okay.
Well, that's toxic Avenger, but same difference.
Well, I'll say living in Atlanta, I probably was doing that anyway.
Maybe everyone just has superpowers now. We just don't realize it because it's so normal.
The superpower of saying incendiary things on X. But hey, people do have that superpower. That's for sure. I don't think I do. I just post my podcast, but. I was saying that in a different podcast a few weeks ago, like one thing in Japan is, you know, like people usually just keep their opinions to themselves.
Is there a, I mean, this is sound ignorant. Is there like a Japanese X?
There have been platforms. Yes.
So like what are the kind of thing? Cause here, if someone's like, oh, what's American Twitter about? It's usually like, oh, it's people getting in the flame wars or like shaming people or just lots of hot takes. I feel so out of home when it comes to Twitter because I don't have a lot of hot takes about things that are going on currently. And it's like everyone seems so informed about so many minute things and they've got opinions on them. And I just don't know about any of it. Like I might have an opinion. I just don't know enough to form one.
Well, you know, the downside is the Japanese political climate is glacial at best. So, you know, nothing ever changes. It takes forever for things to change. But people don't get in like pointless arguments with each other as much. So that's nice because you're trying to avoid, people want to avoid conflict in Japan. So, I don't know. I kind of like that. I mean, with podcasts, I try not to throw out hot takes. I want to put out, you know, things that anyone can listen to. Right. So. At least if they want to hear about weird stuff in our case, but not everybody wants to hear about, you know, homunculuses and the ancient history.
Well, they
of
should.
Eagles,
that's the point is that
they should.
And sometimes you need to hold them down and just like,
I will tell you about this homunculus.
Yeah, you're going to listen about this homunculus and you're going to like it.
No, I've thrown that word into casual conversation the past few months, usually to weird blank stares, which is kind of the point of throwing in casual conversation anyway, right? So but hey, if someone asks, you got a very interesting thing to talk about with them. So
my explanation always ends with a lonely old man having a pleasurable experience and then burying it outside the back of his house and then putting dung on top of it, which is that's the ultimate summary.
Yeah. Out of context, that certainly makes it wild. So let's see if I have any other dumb notes here. Open Sesame is a bad password. If you never use that as your password, someone's going to guess it. although it is an incantation. So there's that, I guess. If you just said something else like, you know, swordfish, that's not so much of an incantation, but. Our passwords are personal incantations. We keep them to ourselves. You know, we have a few weird ones. That's a little thought. The cyber incantation. That's how you do the magic of computers. Sorry,
yeah,
I'm
maybe.
Going away.
It's like the secret hand. Maybe that's in the future, is that to like log on to your computer, you're going to have to give it like a secret handshake with like the Android.
That'd be fun. You create your own with an Android. Have your robot.
I mean, right now you do like the swipe pattern, right? You like design your own swipe. So in the future, it'll be like crazy handshakes.
Yeah, yeah. What are my other dumb notes? Oh, when Miss Bianca says Bernard the boy, I instantly thought that sounds like a terrible indie rock band. So there's that. Bernard the boy, with a comma, of course. A comma has to be there. Nuts on eggs. Why did I write that? Oh, because John Candy is having to sit on the eggs, which the eggs bite him back at the end. Yeah, as our stinger joke. Almost literally.
Insert Steve Irwin joke here.
Ooh. Too soon after 15 years or whatever it's been.
We're still keeping his name alive, so.
Well, yeah, it was a fun show. He seemed very happy on screen.
He was a good guy, right? Nothing. He never got me too'd, right?
Yeah, I don't think so. Who knows these days? But I do not believe so.
Well, at least not by anyone in the human species.
Yeah. This is I guess my final thought is, you know, this is an hour 17, I think, and Disney animated movies are. This is about the tipping point where they're going to start becoming more like. Prop, not quote unquote proper length. This
yeah,
is our
I'm
last
not looking
kind of
forward
condensed.
To it, man. I'm not I mean, looking
they
forward
don't,
to it.
Well, the animated ones still stick around like 90 minutes, right? It's not like they're sending you in for an Avengers Endgame or something. But yeah, they're gonna notch up just a bit. So, but yeah, this is an interesting spot where the storytelling's still the script of this movie and the story is the thing I like the least about it is still stuck in that kind of 70s 80s. Disney vibe, like
yeah 100%.
The Little Mermaid broke out of it and they're going to take it wherever in the future, so I if you got something else do shout out, but our next up is Beauty and the Beast, which I've never seen, so it'll be
that's
my first
gonna be
viewing.
A good one, man. That's gonna be and, good because I've been on a freaking rabbit hole that ties direct, like Beauty and the Beast is the perfect analogy for this topic, so I'm looking forward to it.
Okay. No, because my Australian friend who I talk to on the phone several times a week and almost tried to get an invite to this, but he's getting him into a Zoom is sometimes a little bit tricky, so I didn't. But yeah, he's got kids, I think they're like maybe 7 and 9 now. So he's seen Beauty and the Beast several times recently, and you know, he's into like conspiratorial rabbit holes and stuff. So
oh yeah.
I mean, when we started doing this podcast a year ago, it's like, when are you going to do Beauty and the Beast? I'm like, it's going to be a while, man. So
calm down, dude. Well, we're here now.
No, because he said of ours, he listened to our Roger Rabbit, he listened to Fantasia. Like, I will listen to Beauty and the Beast when you do it. So, you know, there's people looking forward to it. And I've intentionally, like, not been watching it, especially once we started this, because all I've seen was, I saw the Christmas movie version of it. Like, there was
I have not seen that one. Maybe I'll watch that one, too.
It's not good. I don't know. No, it's not good. It was just, I think by that time, my friend was already, like, rapping negatively on Beauty and the Beast itself, so it was fun. The Christmas one.
Did you ever see the TV show? I think it was
the Linda Hamilton Beast? Thing.
Yeah, the Linda Hamilton one.
I remember that's one of those shows that I probably could have liked more, like Highlander, but it came on just before or just after Next Generation. So
okay.
That's what I. It was always like, that's what I want to see. I want to see Next Gen. So I was like, this thing I have to get through. Ah, it's over. Now I have to watch this. That's kind of how those shows ran.
Yeah, that's how David the Gnome was for me.
Because Highlander is a very good show. Like, it's probably better in the movie. But yeah, at the time, I was like, no. Give me the Friday the 13th TV anthology TV series. That's another one that would just things that aired around Next Gen, like, were not Next Gen and made me unhappy.
It made you just like hate everything in proximity to Next Gen.
Right. Same with that's with Saturday morning cartoons, right? I love the Muppet Babies, so whatever was before or after the Muppet Babies.
Dude, Snorkels. Whenever the Snorkels came on, it was like, oh God, anything but Snorkels. Because it was between like Smurfs and Garfield or something. It was between
That's the Snorks?
Snorks, that's what I mean.
Yeah, okay, yeah, because I was talking about snorkeling 10 minutes ago.
yeah. I remember the Snorks came on, and that was like, oh, there's nothing else I can change that. Like, there was when, you know, I sound like an old man, but that was back when there was only like 7 channels or 13 channels.
Yeah, I remember liking Snorks a lot. I like the Smurfs. I do remember not being so much into the Gummy Bears or actually the Disney cartoons as a kid were not my jam. Like,
yeah, they weren't that great.
To be
Care
over.
Bears was pretty good.
Well, Gummy Bears has a fantastic theme, but that's the show itself I remember nothing about. So
it wasn't great. And they weren't real gummy bears. I always thought that was kind of a ripoff. They were just normal bears.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like how the Spice Girls were not actual spices.
Well, I mean, we don't know that yet. You have to wait for them to dry and powder and depends on how coarse you pepper them in the mill.
I guess ginger's a real spice. is ginger a spice? I guess that's a root, isn't it? I'm known to my wife as the ginger thief, because if we go to a sushi place, I'll eat all the ginger.
like swallow it?
Yeah, because it's a ginger. It's like the palate cleanser that you're supposed
to have. Yeah, but I thought, sushi, right? I mean, maybe this is me being a bumpkin, but I thought you literally used it as like a palate cleanser. Like, you put it on your tongue, you wipe it around, you take it back out of your mouth and put it back on the plate.
Nah, you eat that
really?
For dinner last night. My wife actually, she cooked like, beef and green peppers or whatever. It was just not much. So then other people were eating something she knew I didn't like. So she's like, here, have a giant plate of ginger, which I quite enjoyed.
Do you think the sushi chefs are like giving it weird looks when they like, what's this weirdo doing? Like, wiping his tongue with ginger and putting it back on the plate.
Actually, they probably are thinking that's weird. You should eat the ginger, man. It's delicious. Now you know. So yeah, it's a palate cleanser that you can swallow.
I don't know if I believe that. I'm gonna have to look this up.
I've eaten so much ginger. Okay.
people do. It doesn't mean anything. I've eaten some things that most, but anyways, I do have a couple extra notes. One I wanted to note that this, along with the kid talking to nature, yet again, here's a kid getting kidnapped from his parents. So it's the Disney formula. I mean, it beats you over the head.
That's definitely the Rescuers formula. Like, I feel like that's what the Rescuers do. Like, if they made a third Rescuers, I would expect that same situation. Now, yes, it's also the Disney MO, but especially in the Rescuers.
Yeah, well, kidnapping in particular when it comes to the Rescuers, as opposed to, like, getting lost or, like, someone dying.
Or getting your dogs kidnapped, yeah.
Dude, I mean, a live-action Rescuers. I'm interested.
They could pull off one of these. What have they done the live action that worked? I remember watching I haven't watched most of these, but I remember watching The Jungle Book and not hating it. remember Maleficent being okay-ish.
I think that was a musical, so I didn't really get into it.
Yeah. This one's not. This is an interesting point where they, like Black Cauldron, this has no songs that the characters sing.
Oh, wow. I honestly just realized that as you said it. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe that's
on
part
Alex
of the magic that's missing. Maybe it needed some musicals about being a klepto parasitic eagle.
Well, with the success of Little Mermaid, they're all musical all the time. It's only 5 years later, again, with Toy Story or Pixar. It's like, hey, here's an animation with no songs that the characters sing. So
I like that too, man. I mean, I know it's definitely polarizing, but I love me some Randy Newman. So
Yeah, it is funny that they took someone who was so sarcastic in the 70s. Well, he's gonna sing for kids now? Yes, he's gonna sing for your kids, exactly.
So, okay, I got a couple other brief notes here. One is that this is an interesting movie in that we see a combination of nature making use of technology. So you got like, I can't remember if it was like little mice or something, but they understand how to send like Morse code. They know how to type on computers. They basically are like hacking the system. So this is an example of mice or animals talking to the human world, but the human world doesn't understand it, you know, or they don't realize that they're talking to an animal. So in that case, like the animal is almost superior to the humans in a weird Disney way. The mice use a downed airplane to send this Morse code to Hawaii. Then a mouse in Hawaii intercepts that. He makes a call to a soldier. The soldier gets distracted, which is when they get to hack onto the computer. And then they can send this message from LA to Denver to St. Louis to Chicago. So it's just like the mice have this global internet communication worked out to a T, better than humans do in this movie. And then there's also this passing reference to Wilbur, the albatross, who they explain away as Orville's brother. So it's not the same exact albatross, even though it like looks the same. And I guess he couldn't say, oh, yeah.
The Orville. Actor whose name I've already forgotten again.
Orville died. Yeah, but here we've got Wilbur. But Wilbur makes a Charles Lindbergh reference, and I can't ever have Charles Lindbergh's name come up without saying he probably killed his own baby. So that's one of my favorite American conspiracy theories.
Think about the Wright brothers, although maybe they have their own conspiracy theory. I don't know.
And then so Jake, Wilbur hurts his back. Jake sends him to the hospital. And while Wilbur is in the hospital, these like crazy nurses, they strap him down. They just inject him with like a green liquid. Like no one tells him what's going on, what's happening. So they all come down and the doctor comes by and he's like loving. He's like a sadistic doctor. Clearly, like the doctor is probably Swiss, maybe German, and like really loves inflicting this pain and seeing Wilbur being just terrified. And he says they all come in with a whimper and leave with a bang. And then he says, don't force me to take drastic measures, pulls out 120 milligram, syringe of something. And then they're like trying to aim the syringe. And he says 3 degrees, right down 2 degrees. If anyone's into the numerology of like the 32, but then they just shoot this needle into Wilbur, and that's how he gets his injection. There was something about, he mentions Charles Lindbergh, so I'm already thinking World War II Germans, you know, sympathetic. And then all of a sudden this weird like MK Ultra Mengele German guy. Doctor shows up like with green liquid. Anyways, it was kind of a creepy scene, man. It was actually a legitimately scary scene.
Excuse me, that's the scene for your drug supercut, not the flying one. Sorry.
Right, I missed my note. That's what kicks it off. You see him first, and then Fantasia starts.
Yeah.
What else? And then they have the place they're going in the movie is Suicide Trail, which goes through Nightmare's Canyon, and then the other option is Satan's Ridge. So I thought that was interesting. Like, even in Peter Pan, they kind of have a reference to cannibalism, like there might be cannibals out here, but in this movie it's just straight up, yeah, Suicide Trailer, Satan's Ridge, which where you want to go. So I thought that was like kind of interesting for a Disney movie. They also had Bloodworm Creek, and Dead Dingo Pass. Those were the other things that were on the map that they didn't say out loud, but I paused it. And yeah, Bloodworm Creek sounds pretty terrifying, to be honest.
Australia will kill you, I guess, is the point. I'm trying to look. My family comes from Delaware. And I just remember when we were driving from my grandparents' house to my aunt's house on the beach, we kept going over rivers like the Schuylkill River, the Murder Kill River. You know, yeah, this is, man, Delaware, you know?
They don't have a great name. And honestly, a lot of that just has to do with the previous inhabitants and how they left.
But Google Maps does not give you the river's names, because I was trying to find. But I know Murder Kill is one of them, because you don't forget the Murder Kill River. That's just like, that's kill as in K-I-L, right? But
and then let me see what else I got here. Yeah, I have the same note on Open Sesame. Although it's interesting, the origins on Open Sesame do have some occult links, but we'll bring that back up in Aladdin, because that's going to be way more relevant then.
Okay, sounds like a winner.
And in The Rescue, I just want to note that the mouse might actually kill the poacher, potentially. Like, it doesn't actually happen in the movie, but the actions that they take could have very easily resulted in the death of this poacher. So that's also something that you don't see as often. Although, what was the one, the Great Mouse Detective, where they're on the big clock tower? That's kind of implied that, you know, whoever falls from that isn't getting back up from it. So there's a similar one on here. And it only is noteworthy because Disney definitely dials that back in coming movies, where there's less, like, you know, permanent fate implied and more of someone just gets, you know, like, humiliated in public or something.
Yeah, yeah, that's the Aladdin thing. I guess Beauty and the Beast. Well, does it have a villain? We'll talk about that next time. Well, it's got that one guy, I guess. But I mean, I, again, haven't watched it. It's going by hearsay. I'll get to it. Yeah, I'm trying to think of Disney villains that eat it later on.
A lot of the time now they have like a comeback storyline where they, you know, they come to atonement. But also, there's less of a reason to kill the Disney villains off, because you're going to make a live-action movie of them in 20 years from whenever the movie came out.
Three straight-to-video animated sequels.
Yep.
Here's one. Well, of course, we're going to get to this one eventually, but I do remember Atlantis having a pretty high body count. Like, surprisingly high body count.
I'm looking forward to that one, yeah. That one,
that's,
I remember.
That's a good one.
I saw that was the first Disney movie that I actively watched as, like, I would say an adult-ish, like, I would think it was like 19 or 20 maybe when it came out. I don't remember exactly, but I remember seeing that and being like, wow, this is actually a legitimately really cool story that I enjoyed watching.
No, that is a good movie. We watched it about 5 years ago. I was like surprised how good the story actually was, and, you know, how much intelligence was in it. And we'll have plenty of occult stuff to talk about on that one for sure.
Well, about Atlantis? What is that, like, based on something?
Yeah, I don't know. I think they just made it for the movie.
What will Disney think of next? They're so original.
Did you have any other bits on the notes? I'm pretty sure I've cashed out on mine.
Yeah, I've got, I think that was all of it. I went down a really, really deep rabbit hole of, like, all of the magical birds and eagles and stuff. And I came across one, I'm just curious if you ever heard of it, called Jinwu, the three-legged crow.
Is that Chinese?
Korean? I think it's Chinese, yeah. It's not Japanese, it's Chinese.
Yeah, I don't think I've heard of that.
So in Japanese culture, they also have a similar one, and it's called, God forgive me for this pronunciation, Yatagarasu, or the eight-span crow.
That sounds a little, probably because it's just because it's Japanese. Although I'm guessing it's probably a Pokemon based on it too. So
I guess no animal is safe from having a Pokemon named after it. But it says that it's mentioned in a number of places in Shinto, and the depictions are primarily seen on Edo wood art. Is that how you pronounce that?
Yeah, Edo, but yeah.
Edo wood art. Although not celebrated today, the crow is a mark of rebirth and rejuvenation. Animal has historically cleaned up after great battles, symbolizing Renaissance after tragedy, which is Very true. And that's also why the medieval times, the ravens would be seen as these like omens, because when there was a huge swath of ravens that would come through, like, you knew they were going to pick on dead bodies from a battlefield, most likely.
I had actually just 2 nights ago when I was walking home from work, walking to a train station, I walked past a temple, and they were having a somewhat late night, 9 p.m. ceremony, which is pretty trippy. Some guys banging on small drums, a flute player, and someone, in a dragon costume dancing around, and only about 5 people spectating. So it was kind of trippy.
That's like every night in Florida here.
Okay. Were they rave? But not like a rave. This was like a religious ceremony. So.
Oh, no. This is just people on bath salts.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, they weren't on the bath salts.
And it's not really a dragon costume. It's probably more like
naked.
Yeah. Yeah.
Eating off some faces, that sort of thing.
Same,
but
same thing. Yeah. It's crazy.
I'm kind of bringing it up just because it was like kind of fun just walking down the street. And I mean, I guess I could have even gone and stood and watched for a while, but it's like kind of fun just to pass it by, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that just shows the difference in culture, because I would love to walk by that happening in the middle of the night and think fun and not think like, do I have my gun on me right now? And if not, let me walk across the street.
When I lived back in Atlanta for a couple of years, having lived in Japan already, I did start to really miss the idea of just random temples and shrines being everywhere, because the church is not.
Oh, cool. An alley. Well. Let's walk down this alley and you're never heard from again.
Whereas in Japan, you walk down an alley and you find a little red Shinto shrine.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely a different. I would not recommend just doing that in random alleys in Atlanta or almost any major city.
No. And I got back from Okinawa, last week. I got to the train station about 5 kilometers at midnight, just walked the 5K home. So not a great idea in many places in America, but
no.
With carrying a ukulele and a bag full of stuff.
Big target on the back that says I've got hundreds, crisp hundreds.
Yeah. I mean, no, I don't tell you where I live too much, but no, people in Japan, I regularly walk around with like $200 in cash in my pocket. Which
sticking out of the pocket like a dare.
yeah just come on, get it. But no, you do carry around like a bunch of cash in Japan, which I don't remember in America ever carrying more than like $20. Mm-hmm. So kind of interesting. Rescuers carry no money though, because they're mice. Is that how it works? I don't know. Do I have an economy? It's not clear. They have technology. Do they have an economy?
Well, they're kind of like the UN, right? So they're probably, they've got some kind of like universal currency, a one world currency.
Ah, okay. They're a test.
It might test be social credits only.
Right.
Actually, that's why they're out saving people, is like they're just trying to pay off their carbon credits.
That's why Bernard, who is not qualified for this job, is doing it.
Right. He's resolving previous transgressions.
Even this movie is like, I'm not the guy for this, because he's not the guy for any of this, is he? I guess that's what makes him mildly funny, like, or charming or whatever.
Kind of, although he's clearly, in my opinion, he's not the star of this movie, even in a small way.
No, I kind of forgot about the rescuers, like, 3/4 of the way in. Yeah. I was like, wait a minute, aren't there some mice in this? I'd also take a 10 minute nap and get lost back.
Like, they're not the strongest lead characters.
The first time I watched this, it was a little late, and I did fall asleep for about 10 minutes and then woke up and didn't realize it. I was like, what happened to the mice? Because I guess I just fell asleep when they were on screen. So I got this version where there was like even less of them. Then I went back and watched it again, so that's why I was perfectly happy that we delayed this by a few days, because I had kind of piecemealed it and taken a little movie nap, so it worked out for me well. I guess we'll wrap it up. What's up in your world besides Slimer back there?
Oh man, so I've got a comic that's going to be released on Friday the 13th, so if you're watching this in the future, you should be able to either go directly to it or go to the paranoidamerican.com and maybe find a copy. But it's called Frazzle Drip Funhouse, and it's about an animatronic bear that gets possessed and and gets revenge on an evil cult of satanic arcade owners. So it's a crazy one-shot comic that's based on B horror movies. It does not hold back on all of the cheesy one-liners. It doesn't hold back on like the gore and just like the over the top being crude for the sake of it. So it's definitely an adult oriented comic. There's no like boobies or anything, but there's lots of horrible gore and blood and guts and ways to die. So I think that's pretty good for this movie as well. Leading out from our Disney into the Frizzle Drip Funhouse. So you can say in many ways, Disney was a big influence in even wanting to make a Frazzle Drip comic book. So that's what I've got going on this one. ParanoidAmerican.com, Frazzle Drip Funhouse.
Yeah, I just realized it's an October Friday the 13th. Okay, that's pretty right. Wild. Yeah, that means like for the weather on the whiteboard for my classes on Friday, I get to draw sunny Jason or cloudy Jason. That's always fun. I have one class. They're like 11-year-olds, I guess. And every week, because I'm like, okay, I'll draw cloudy on the board. What kind do you want? Happy, crazy, angry, sad, and the past few months they've been asking me for world leaders. So they'll be like, we want Putin cloudy, or we want Kishida sunny. So I'll look up the image. We did Kim Jong sunny once. That was fun. so yeah, that's how I entertain myself at work, at least drawing Kim Jong sunny for children.
You get killed for doing that.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, no. We're just watching the Asian Games are going on right now. So right before I got on, breakfast, the game was screening downstairs with North Korea versus Japan. I'm like, maybe they should just let North Korea win, because if they lose and they go home, it's not good for them. It turned out Japan beat them 4-1. So I was like, ooh, I don't know.
It's like going against like the Iraqi soccer team in the late 90s.
Yeah, yeah. So
like you know what happens if they lose, right? Like now you're kind of a dick for winning.
Just let them win. Just let them win. North Korea wins again the championship. But hey, if you really want to be nice, you let them win. I guess I'm not a sports fan or a competitor, so I can say that.
Just let North Korea have everything. Just let them have it.
Yeah, yeah. What's up with me? Okay. I do other podcasts. You can support those on Patreon at Podcastio Podcastius. We talk about movies at Films and Filth, The Twilight Zone, and recently the show One Step Beyond at Time Enough Podcast. Space 1999, we're doing a podcast on that now called Podcast 1999. If you want a show that really throws in the mystical, the esoteric in with the sci-fi, that's a fun trip. And there's some gamer ones. Like I said, I can ask Luke about that Pokemon, because Luke loves Pokemon. Hyrule Field Report about Zelda, and the game show where British gamers game each other about games. Okay, I think I got all that out, so...
All right, so the next one is Beauty and the Beast, right?
See y'all then.
All right, see y'all.
Ohio football fans, picture this. You bet on your favorite player to score the first touchdown, and he throws an awesome block so his teammate can score instead. If this happens, BetMGM wants to give you another chance at the end zone. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you'll get your stake back if your first touchdown scorer scores second instead. That's right. Bet on any pro football player to score the first touchdown of the game. If you're right, you win. If your player scores second, you get your stake back in cash. Everyone knows the most exciting part of football is the score. With BetMGM's second chance promotion, you have a chance to keep the fun going even after the first player crosses the goal line. Plus, you can enjoy second chance all season long. Place a first TD scorer wager today. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.
New Jersey's got a lot of historic wows, from Victorian beach towns to Revolutionary War battlegrounds. Explore wow after wow at more than 463 historic landmarks. In museums, lighthouses, and over 58 state and national parks. It's one wow after another after another. You get it. Find your wow at visitnj.org/history. New Jersey, little state, lot of wow.